a lot of the equipment on this space station is designed to be done by this type of equipment, this type of robotic equipment. The Hubble was not. So you're going to need something with better dexterity aboard the mission when we drop it to service something like the Hubble. On top of everything, it's going to be have to be autonomous. The thing will have to pretty much operate on its own in the future to do something like that. You need right now. You'll have an astronaut on board, essentially using remote control to operate this robotic equipment that's going to be delivered to the space station. The Hubble, you won't. You won't have a guy sitting on board up there. It'll be launched in space and unmanned craft using the Constellation / Orion system, maybe to get it up there, but you probably won't have a astronauts nearby. Possibly you could, but right now the future for the Hubble is presently going to be canceled after everything fails after this mission. So we'll have to see. The sky is pretty clear tonight. Mars was right overhead a couple of hours ago. Good sight to see. Jupiter was below it at the horizon. But good weather to, you know, now it's getting a little bit warmer to go out and stare at those stars there. Back in that WS.
And I'm a guy who owns a 8-inch diameter Schmidt-Cassegrain grain telescope, which I should be using a little bit more. I also own a charge couple device camera that I should be hooking up to it and see what it all can do. Fun type stuff. Modern-day equipment that you can put in your backyard can take astrophotography, as I've said before, which 15, 20 years ago, Palomar Observatory would be kind of proud to display. I'd like to believe, now getting back to Hubble, that the new gyros they're putting up, they've sort of found out more about what creates gyro failures, so hopefully they're going to last a little longer. The new batteries they're going to put in, hopefully are a better grade of batteries. The new computer they're going to put in will have a little more longevity to it. I know they're putting in new sensing devices. So I'd like to believe that the 5 years you estimated could be in, more like 10 years, that we're going to get out of Hubble. When it comes to a autonomous robot-like thing to do a Hubble repair, I'm still worried, even if we wait another 5 or 10 years. When I was using my satellite receiving system to watch Story Musgrave live for 8 hours at a time, doing all the operations of a repair mission, let me drop. And what he was doing was extremely well practiced ahead of time. Yet on the spot, he had to make various decisions as to what screw to go seek because it went flying off into the cargo hold, or all kinds of things that were unanticipated happened. It was a very delicate operation, taking this great big chunk of apparatus that was the new sensing assembly with the new eyeglasses, so to speak, with a very delicate head on the front of it, and carefully jockeying that into the middle of the Hubble and bolting it down. And then the degree of difficulty of closing those doors under the differential thermal expansion of space and so on. Rather elaborate operation. For a non-human to do that, to take a man with that much adaptability, and he could just barely do it, I'm quite worried. The next thing I'm worried about, Paul, is that we're going to have another Hubble-like device in space. I guess it's the James Webb, but what is the current anticipated best guess date as to when the replacement for Hubble will be available for launch, and what spacecraft is going to launch it? WS2S, K2LAW in the deck head.
The Delta 2s are usually the ones that launch these things, but that's something that big, they'll be using the Atlas V. That's the newest one that has come online. I think it's made one flight so far, two flights. So hopefully that'll work out. 2000 and... That's a ways away. 2011? 10. We've got 2-3 years, I think, before that thing goes up. So, you know, it's like anything else. That thing is, talk about being complicated. You know, you've got 36 segmented mirrors that have got to be reassembled in space all by themselves, 1 million miles out, not serviceable by robots or people. So, I don't know. They keep saying the new field is the robotic. You know, everybody, all those young guys now, you know, they're getting out of school, they're getting into the robotics now. Put out with computers. That was a big thing. Engineering has always been there, but if it's a robotic one, I think that might be the future stick, and hopefully there's an acceleration and development of that field, and something might be able to occur. But the James Webb telescope, named after James Webb, one of the early administrators of space of NASA. We'll see if this thing works out. There's other missions that are planned that could look into the universe. Don't think that's the only one. There's a couple of other ones that are being planned as well. That's a big one. I consider that the replacement of the Hubble Space Telescope. I'm going to drop this section. The next thing that we really have to look for is the Mars landing of the Phoenix spacecraft in May. And that's the next probably big thing. Space Station News outside of on the net, or on on a computer, information is going to be hard to come by unless there's big problems, you know, disasters in space. The last mission really wasn't covered very much by the newspapers or the TV, but the next probably big thing will be the Phoenix mission. That will be covered probably, I think, extensively by TV and the news. I might be wrong. I guess wrong with the Barbara Morgan mission, the teacher in space, the woman that was actually scheduled second to go up after Kristen McCullough with the disaster of the Challenger. Guess wrong with that. I thought the news media was going to cover that left and right, and you barely heard anything about that mission a year ago, less than a year ago. So we'll have to see. One space news, check into the net. Back to you, Dick WS.
So this is where it's happening. This is where people have to go to get their concentrated space news. Well done, Paul. Mel? You better read a little bit faster. That was a joke. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech net.
This is K2KEY, very interesting. Always is. Alrighty, let's read through a few of these, see what I can put out on the air, and answer a few questions. I get quite a number of them. A lot of them can't be bring up on the air. By the way, one final thing on smoking and all. I have a friend that is Chinese descent and was a pretty heavy smoker. And I mentioned it to him that maybe it's not so good to smoke so many cigarettes. And he says, no, it doesn't really have much of a negative effect on us Chinese because course, we have an antidote for it. And I said, what is that? And he says, the tea we drink this black tea called Oolong tea. He says, very good, takes the toxicity out of your body, and it's very healthy for you. So we've been drinking our tea. It's good tea. And how much truth there is to it, I don't know. But they now, once in a while, see an article that claims that the Chinese Oolong black tea are extremely good in antioxidants. Something in the tea seems to ward off a number of different diseases. I'm just mentioning that while I'm looking at the emails. Over.
My wife keeps track of various things like that. I'm going to have to ask her about that one, and maybe we'll be drinking it too. Do you brew your own, or can you buy it already made in bottles, Mel?
Brew it. I have a little thing, you know, take the loose tea, put it in this little container, this little stainless steel thing that you put into boiled water, and it's delicious. That's it. It just has to be a nice aroma to it besides great tasting tea. It's called Oolong, O-O-L-O-N, I believe it's O-O-L-O-N-G, Oolong? Yeah, Oolong tea, Dick. Ask the SYL, she may know about that, Dick. I think it's also been mentioned in a number of these, you know, articles on that, you know, things that you can easily do to help ward off different types of conditions. Also, I'm a firm believer, also, another doctor came up with another thing for people like us that live in smoky environments and all, and that's nose-steady. That chelates the nose, very good to wash, it actually washes out your nose like a funnel device, and the water goes in one nostril and goes out the other. It takes a little time to get used to, but highly recommended by supposedly a very famous physician in New York Hospital there.
Is this waterboarding?
No, it's not. That's a new one on me, Mel. I haven't heard about that one.
Called the nose netting. And cute little gadget that's made out of porcelain and all. It's got like a sort of a funnel tip. And you fill it with water, a little water, and put a little salt in it. And you hold your head to, like, to the side slightly, and you pour the water and pour it in, and it goes in one nostril and washes out the other. Yeah, I guess it's water torture of some sort, but we've been doing that the last couple of years, and so far, you know, we haven't had any, we seem to have no cold the last couple of years. Maybe there's something to it, Dick. I can't say for sure.
And are you saying no flu also? Almost everybody got this last flu, and it was a pretty tough one. Ed, this is reasonably late for you. You happen to be traveling from point A to point B?
No, but I do have a comment.
Go right ahead with your comment.
How many generations have the Chinese been heavily smoking tobacco? I don't think there's enough of a database to back up that guy's statement. To me, it smacks more of wishful thinking than hard data.
Yeah, no matter what you smoke, when you burn an organic material like tobacco leaves, and you make 100 or so various chemicals, a good percentage of them are carcinogenic, and day after day you smear that onto this extremely delicate organ, which is essentially one cell thickness between the air and the blood, and you expect that organ to keep repairing itself from that damage you're doing, no matter what your nationality, no matter what other corrective action you take, I think it's a poor thing to do. What's your opinion on that one, Ed?
I agree with you 100%, and most tea is, in this country, is oolong tea. And I drink it. It's probably good for you. But it's kind of like, you know, wearing a seatbelt won't help if a supersonic jet hits the ground. Wearing a life jacket won't help if you go over Niagara Falls. You get the idea.
I sure do. Back to you, Mel.
So much for Oolong Tea. All right, this is ATKY. So, okay, I enjoy it anyhow. How do I determine the ground effect of for a Yagi antenna? In other words, so what do I do? How high up do I have to put it? It's a way to determine Yagi antenna design and the ground or earth effect on that Yagi. Well, there's several ideas on that, but I'll let you comment on that. What do you think of the height of the antenna, and what would you say is a good rule of thumb, Dick? Go ahead.
Yeah, as a Yagi is placed near the ground, two or three things happen. If you're super close to the ground, the reflection off the ground, even though the Yagi is parallel to the ground, you're still sending out some signal sideways, and the reflection off the ground is going to change the tuning of your antenna, if you're tuning it, and the standing wave ratio you're going to experience. If you're trying to get a good signal out to the horizon, you'll rapidly discover that whether the antenna is 5 feet off the ground, 15 feet, 25, 75, 105. The more altitude, the more signal you're going to get out to the horizon, the guys further away are going to hear you. So on VHF frequencies, altitude is everything. And you're doing it not to make the Yagi clear the ground, but you're doing it primarily to keep your point of emission above all the local stuff. Earth curvature, local trees, local buildings, water towers, and all that kind of jazz. Homes, you want to get above it all for best VHF performance. But when it comes to testing the Yagi itself on, let's say, a backyard antenna range, and I've spent quite a few hours of my life back in the late 70s, early 80s doing that, I came to an interesting set of conclusions, and that is, let me drop, that every Yagi antenna has a calculatable effective capture area. For instance, the 19 element Yagi, called an RIW-19 insulated Yagi, which has approximately 15 dB or 15.5 dB of gain over dipole, has an effective capture area, which is a 5.7 foot diameter circle. I've done a bunch of experiments that have reasonably confirmed that. Not absolutely traceable to the Bureau. If you want to argue with me that it's a 5.3 or a 6.1 foot diameter, close enough. Something in a 5.7 foot diameter circle. If the Yagi is being held above the ground so that none of that circle touches the ground, you're going to essentially get the performance of the antenna properly measured on your antenna range. So you could say the Yagi being more than 3 feet, 3.5 feet above the ground is going to do it. The Yagi has about a 12-foot long boom, so in that particular case, 1/4 to 1/3 of the boom length is probably the right answer. On most Yagi antennas of good design, the effective capture area is a relatively simple relationship to boom length. So for every Yagi you're testing, if you placed it at least a third of the boom length above the ground and more for long Yagis, you're doing the right thing. Now, for a two-element Yagi, there may be another set of rules that persist. I wouldn't take a two-element Yagi with a super short boom and place it that close to the ground. I'd like to be at least a half wavelength above the ground. So let's call it half wavelength or one-third of boom length is a good rule of thumb for the beginning numbers where you're going to get full performance on your antenna range. That's sort of where I'm coming from, Mel. Maybe you guys at the Kings County Radio Club, when you do your shootouts of your antenna tests out there at Floyd Bennett Field, I wonder what set of rules you guys tend to use. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I've read a number of articles, and of course this question has come up a number of times in casual conversation. You know, how high is high, or how high is enough? And, you know, the old cliche, put it up high, that high as you can, that your mother would say to you, you're not going up there, you know, or something to that effect. But in real world, ground, boy, I guess real ground, soil, whatever it is, varies, but I would assume that real ground has what would we call it, a finite conductivity, so that, let's say at 20 meters, 14 megahertz, that the current which would flow, you know, at the on the ground would be what considered what we call what top skid, so that if we were to elevate, let's say this 20 meter beam, say 20, 21 meters up over this supposedly average ground and finite ground, I would think that that would sort of put us into a ballpark for like 20 meters where we are, you know, looking for somewhat long-range radio communication, and depending mostly on the F2 layer, which I guess varies between, what, 250 and 400 kilometers, so that actually what are we using? The F2 layer basically is, I guess, we call it a reflector. I guess we could really say it is a refraction that we're using. Am I correct? Is that the correct way to actually say what's happening on HF communication, that we're using the F2 layer as a refractionary type of medium over?
Yeah, a little bit on the complicated side. Simplistically, we could always call it ionospheric reflection, and you're close. That is to say, you zoom way back and watch the action. If you could see the radio wave, it would look like a reflection. In reality, the ionosphere is a plasma. The plasma has a higher than normal local dielectric constant, and it's also mixed with a magnetic field. The magnetic field mixing in that plasma gives you Faraday rotation. That horizontally polarized 40 meter signal you launch is going to go into that ionosphere. It doesn't just reflect off of its surface. It penetrates it some significant distance. In the presence of the magnetic field and the plasma phenomena, that wave gets rotated some number of turns before it comes back out of the ionosphere. The ionosphere is a refracting medium. It also has some properties of excitation and re-radiation. So a lot goes on. I don't know if there are very many books that will put it clearly, but simplistically call it reflection, but a lot more is going on. The way the signal refracts as a function of frequency, the so-called maximum usable frequency, is another thing, an awful lot of fun worth studying. A function of how dense is the ionosphere, how well ionized is it. My best guess, Mel, is refraction is a major phenomenon. K2KE1, K2LIW.
I know it's a very interesting subject, and of course, being a, you know, an HF operator, I have looked into this in depth and actually see, you know, really how high up the beam should be, what it, really how it should perform. Would you say that a single hop on, let's say, 20 meters, a single hop on Earth is, in other words, is it limited? In other words, can we honestly say that this can only go so far on a single hop, and that for very long communication, that no matter how much power, how big the antenna is, you're still going to have to involve several hops if, say, if you wanted to go from here to Australia. I mean, there is no way that you could angle the antenna or raise it high enough that you could actually say, I could go from point A to B, like around the world, on a single hop. Is it a finite, as far as I've seen so many contradictions on different, you know, theories of what really takes place. So is that true, that it is a finite hop on how far you can go on one, in other words, one hop, the maximum range on Earth? Is that correct, Dick? In other words, is it a factor?
I think it definitely is, Mel. And depending on which one of the layers you're using, if I talk about the E layer, sporadic E propagation, 6 meters, 2 meters, 10 meters, to my knowledge, no one has ever gotten really beyond 1,100 or 1,200 miles on one sporadic E hop. The E level has got a certain altitude above the ground, and so if you get the signal leaving your backyard at a grazing angle with the ground, the best you're going to do, and then hit the E layer, the sporadic E cloud, as far away as you possibly can, refract, reflect, or whatever, get the reoriented from that sporadic E cloud, and then come back to Earth again at a grazing angle. It's something like 1,200 miles. So if it's sporadic E that you're using and you want to go beyond 1,200 miles, it's definitely, by the laws of geometry, going to take more than one hop. Let me drop. And by the way, many of us have a mental image of the atmosphere around the Earth, which is extremely optimistic. The majority of the atmosphere is within the first 6 miles, maybe 8 miles. The Earth has a radius of 4,000 miles. So 1/500th or 1/1,000th of the radius of the Earth is the height of the atmosphere. You take that globe that you've got sitting of the Earth, sitting on your desk, the thickness of the air is not a hell of a lot thicker than the thickness of the paint that's on that globe. If any of us drew a simple diagram of the Earth as a circle, and then someone asks you to draw the atmosphere around it, we're going to draw something that's 1/4 of the radius of the Earth. It's more like 1/500th. So that gives you some idea of at least what air mass bending is like, and tropospheric propagation can probably do for you. Now when you get those layers of E and F, and F1 and F2, F2 is a hell of a lot higher, so a grazing angle into F2, I don't know what the maximum distance of it is, but I'm going to make a guess it's something around 2,000 miles. And I'm sure this is much more documented than I know about. But since you know the altitude of the F1 layer and the F2 layer, and you know the geometry of the Earth, you can predict how far one single hop has got to be, maximum, on the assumption you're able to launch the signal completely tangent to the Earth in your backyard. So I think there's a definite finite distance of every one of the modes of propagation. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Let's just carry us one step forward, because I have read quite a bit about this. Maxwell went into a lot of interesting comments about, I guess, similar, you know, but, you know, he covered a large amount of information, and part of it is, you know, a little hard to absorb. When we excite an antenna, let's say we take this 20-meter antenna, see what it's talking about, HF, let's say 14 megahertz, take this 20-meter beam, we stick it, say, 20 meters up over this so-called finite conductivity of real ground. Now, when we excite the antenna, we produce a current distribution into the nearby ground plane effect surfaces, whatever surfaces, ground plane. I think I'm putting it right. That we, maybe I'm not explaining it right, but in other words, reproducing a current distribution into the nearby ground plane surfaces. And is this effect actually coupling back, let's say, some kind of a mutual voltage back into the antenna element, which, in other words, which affects the elements. In other words, is there we call that an interaction. Is that a correct, in other words, you see, it's very hard to picture, but I'm trying to, you know, get into my mind the wording of what exactly he was trying to bring out, Maxwell. Maybe you can break it down for what I'm trying to bring out there. Go ahead.
Yes, I think I see where you're going, Mel. and you're onto a good subject here. And we can take it to the extremes, study the extremes, and then back off from the extreme and make a guess as to what happens in our particular environment. Assume I've got a dipole, in your example, one wavelength above the ground. And let's assume that I have spread a sheet of copper across my whole backyard, so I have perfect conductivity. I know that I've got a real dipole, one wavelength above the ground. I have a mirror image of a dipole, one wavelength below the ground. Wavelength of 20 meters is around 67 feet, so I've got my real dipole 67 feet up. I have a mirror image of another dipole equal in magnitude of signal strength, 67 feet below the ground, but my horizontally polarized dipole obeys one particular rule, and that is you cannot get an E field parallel to a perfect conductor. So therefore, of the wave that comes out the dipole that goes down towards the copper sheet, the portion of it that hits the sheet has to go to zero at the sheet. It's a fancy way of saying you get a perfect reflection, but a 180-degree phase reversal. So therefore, I've got a real dipole above the ground, 67 feet, a mirror image of one, 67 feet below the ground, and they're 180 degrees out of phase with each other. Let me drop a second. If I read the early chapters of the antenna book, they will show you a plot of antenna impedance. Sometimes it's just the total impedance. Sometimes they separate the reactive component from the resistive component. Sometimes they make it a kind of a polar plot where the reactance is vertical and the resistance is horizontal. And as you change altitude of that dipole above perfect ground, it traces a kind of a spiral on that graph where the spiral gets smaller and smaller as you get higher and higher above the ground. It eventually settles on an infinite dipole, an infinite altitude dipole, which is a dipole in free space, and you eventually settle on 72 or 73 ohms of resistance. But when you're closer to the ground, that reflected signal off the ground does affect the impedance you measure. You could call it the mutual impedance effect of your dipole and your mirror image. So there is always a cross-coupling between the various elements of any phased array. That dipole above the sheet of metal in my backyard really is a phased array. It's a two-element antenna. Now, as I start backing away from perfect sheet of metal, and I start slowly replacing my real dirt of my backyard, the dirt of my backyard is less conductive than the copper. So the original copper, radio-wise, was a perfect mirror, very similar to your bathroom mirror, but it's at radio frequencies. If I now start spraying moisture or some other kind of clouding material onto my mirror, I think that is close to what happens into my backyard as I start slowly changing from the perfect sheet of metal to the real dirt that I've got. And there's quite a bit of variation in that conductivity of dirt, depending on whether it's Barry N2MB, who lives on a chunk of land that periodically has seawater washing over it, so I know that his soil is very conductive. By comparison to a guy who lives in the Mojave Desert, where his soil is essentially dry sand, you've got all kinds of variation in possible conductivity. As you go to lower and lower conductivity soil, I say it is like spraying more and more stuff on that bathroom mirror, where the image I get is more and more clouded. The image is getting weaker and weaker. You're always getting a reflection from the ground, but the reflection magnitude gets weaker and weaker as the ground reflectivity, as the ground conductivity gets lower, and you get a little bit of variation of apparent altitude. I think at radio frequencies, most of the soil you and I have has a skin depth of a small number of feet, very small number of feet, compared to the 67 feet of a wavelength. So there's a little bit of shift in phase as my ground becomes less conductive, but I'm still getting a reflection from the ground, but the magnitude of that reflection gets weaker. Therefore, when I plot reflect off that ground, weaker and weaker because I've got less and less ground reflectivity, I get a little bit of shift in the phase, but I get a weaker and weaker signal. Therefore, when I do that plot of total impedance versus altitude, where you're plotting it up and down for plus and minus reactance component and to the right for resistance component. And I got a great big spiral when I did it with perfect conducting. But when I use real finite conducting, that spiral is going to more rapidly spiral into the center of the chart, the 73 ohm point. That's what I think is happening here, Mel. So if we look at it as a mirror, and less conductivity of soil means my mirror is more and more clouded, I think it gives you a little bit more of an impression of what's taking place. That's true for a dipole above Earth. And now if it's a Yagi above Earth, which has got a significant beam width to it, which is aimed out at the horizon, the amount of signal going straight down and reflecting back is significantly smaller. Therefore, the ground effects are significantly decreased as far as the impedance I measure of that Yagi. But when it comes to the ground reflecting effects and the clouding of the mirror, that's going to be the same when it comes to the signal that I radiate to the space. I can predict where the lobes are going to be if all of the Earth was covered with copper. I can predict where the lobes would be if the Earth was a perfectly absorber. There would be no lobes. And in between, I've got this clouded mirror, which is now is changing the magnitude of the reflection off the Earth. Therefore, it's changing the depth of the nulls that are in that vertical elevation pattern because of the real antenna above ground and the mirror image below ground. So I think you can see how starting off with the extremes of perfect conducting soil and zero conducting soil and everything in between, you can sort of paint a picture for those intermediate results, I think. I may be a little simplistic here, but that particular methodology sort of works for me. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right, just let me see if I can put this into other words and see if it makes sense. The antenna over the sheet of copper. Okay, now you said that take the sheet of copper going back to, it would be great, I could say the whole world was covered with this, that we'd have one, you know, particular type of conductivity plane. All right, now we take the average Earth, and the reflected wave that is coming off this so-called medium, it does alter then the space pattern of the antenna. So it actually is changing, to some extent, the property of the antenna. Now, question, can we fix anything by, say, we have this 20-meter beam or whatever, can we do anything by to improve it, say, tilt the antenna or whatever? Is there any way that we can say, oh, yes, we can determine what this medium is that's below us, and we can help to compensate somewhat other than elevation? In other words, this effect, is it changing the property of the antenna to an effect that we can fix something there, Dick, by what, other than going up higher? Or, as I could say, is there a property of tilting or anything, or readjusting elements? Is there anything that we can do for this situation? Over.
Yeah, I've got an answer for this one. Most of the time the answer is no, but I've worked with a man who did do something about it in reality. Once I know the number of wavelengths my Yagi or dipole is above the ground, and once I accept the fact that the mirror image of my dipole or Yagi below the ground is 180 degrees out of phase, if it's a horizontally polarized antenna, and 90-some-odd% of our antennas are horizontally polarized for a bunch of good mechanical reasons. Once I know the locations of the phase center of the real antenna above ground and the mirror image below ground, I now fix in space, out in front of that antenna, the exact altitude of those elevation lobes. It's going to be a kind of a null on the horizon, a peak some number of degrees above the horizon, like one wavelength above the ground. I don't know the exact number, but maybe the first peak of the lobe is going to be 40 degrees above the horizon because of the in-phase and the out-of-phase come back together at that particular angle, 40 degrees above the horizon. As I take the ground conductivity and make it lower and lower, the amount of reflection from the ground decreases, the magnitude of the reflection from the ground decreases. I get the lobe in the same spot, but the lobe is a little bit less strong in its peak, and the nulls are not very deep nulls anymore. See, you got those elevation lobes from interferometry. The peak of the lobe is where the reflection and the real come out in phase, and they reinforce each other. The nulls are where the real and the reflection come out of phase, and they tend to destroy each other. So as the reflection from the ground gets weaker, because the ground is not as conductive, the lobes are essentially in the same place. I'm going to modify that a little in a minute. But the peak is not going to be quite as high, and the nulls are not going to be anywhere near as deep. And as the ground conductivity goes to zero, and there's no reflection, now I have no lobes at all. I have a hemisphere out there of radiation if it's a dipole, and I've got the normal Yagi pattern if it's a Yagi. Now, those lobes are due to the interferometry of a real and an imaginary antenna, one wavelength above the ground, 67 feet on 20 meters, which means my two elements of my antenna are 130 feet apart. The top of my real antenna and the bottom of my image antenna are 130 feet apart. Let me drop. That is a 130-foot interferometer. It has a moment arm to steer the elevation pattern, and it has 130 feet of hardware to do it with. That is an extremely hard, strong interferometer. The real pattern of my antenna has an effective capture area. In the case of my 20-meter Yagi, it may be the equivalent of a 20-foot diameter circle. So my 20-foot diameter circle creates a certain pattern. My 130-foot long moment arm of my interferometer creates an extremely strong pattern. Pattern-wise, I don't have to tell you which one dominates. So if I take that 20-foot diameter circle of my Yagi with its pattern, which maybe is a 40-degree beam width, and now I tilt it down in elevation or up in elevation, and I've got this small little circle of its effective capture area that I'm tilting, and I'm fighting this great big moment arm of 130 feet, for the most part, I'm wasting my time. Lots and lots of guys have taken long Yagis, tilted them above the ground and below the ground, and they thought they saw detriments and improvements. For the most part, I think they're fighting something that's much stronger than them, this interferometry pattern, and I think they were doing very little. Now, there is an exception. I'm going to give that to you right now. And that is a low-angle tracking radar, an X-band tracking radar, 10-foot diameter dish, fancy feed horn with four little horns made to the horn, and you carefully measure amplitude and phase difference between the signals received by the four horns, and you make what's called a monopulse radar. In other words, on one single pulse, it knows the target is in the bore sight, to the left of bore sight, to the right of bore sight, above bore sight, or below bore sight. It's called a monopulse radar because on one single pulse, it figures out where the target is. And if the circuitry of your servo mechanism is smart enough, you then mechanically move the antenna to put the target back into the bore sight. So picture that kind of a monopulse angular tracking radar mounted not too far above the ground at the seashore. And it's tracking an airplane that's flying out to sea. Anyone who has been a radar operator and done that knows immediately he runs into a very strong problem. As the airplane goes from a quarter of a mile to half a mile to 1 mile to 2 miles to 5 miles away from you, and you're continuously tracking it, you rapidly run into a problem where you've got the real target above the sea, you have the mirror image of the target below the sea, and the antenna pretty soon gets confused and it starts hopping back and forth between the two. Because of scintillation effects and the sea state and whatever, there are times when the echo off the water is stronger than the real echo of the antenna of the airplane above the water. So the radar starts hopping up and down, and you could, if you didn't slow down the amplitude of the signal going to the amplodyne or the servo mechanism, you could literally vibrate the antenna off of its pedestal. So the low angle tracking problem of a monopulse radar with a target that's receding away from you on the horizon is a very serious problem. What a buddy of mine did, a guy named Warren White, got a patent for it. He made not four horns to the feed horn assembly out in front of his dish. He made six horns. He combined them in a very intelligent manner where as the airplane is being tracked by the radar and as the airplane is getting closer to the horizon from your point of view and from the radar's point of view, he could predict ahead of time exactly where the reflection off the water is going to be. He used those other two horns in a very intelligent manner to intentionally steer a null in the antenna pattern at the deterministic point of the reflection of the signal of the target below the horizon. He nulled out the water reflected signal. In so doing,
repeater, timeout, cancel,
that low angle tracking radar would perfectly track the target without wobbling up and down. So in that case, at X-band, where he's got an antenna that's got a 1 degree beam width, and the target is 1 degree above the horizon, and the echo of the target off the water is 1 degree below the horizon, he was steering a null in that bottom area, so that now the radar would properly track without jumping up and down. So when you've got that number of wavelengths of resources, a 10-foot diameter dish at X-band is 100 wavelengths in diameter. When you've got that kind of resources and multiple horns as a cluster feed, phased array thing, steering nulls in the right position, yes, you can do something about ground reflection. It's kind of obvious with the 130-foot interferometry. You and I have, with our 20-meter antenna mounted one wavelength above the ground, we don't have anywhere near those resources. So our ability to affect those vertical lobes created by ground reflection is pretty meager. We don't have the resources to do it. But now, if you're starting to stack, if you're K1WHS, you've got 160 foot of Roan 55 tower on top of your mountain, and now you're going to stack a bunch of vertical displaced Yagi antennas on 20 meters. And now you're going to create a phased array out of that vertical stack of 3, 4, or 5 Yagis. And you're going to steer a null into the ground out in front of that antenna. Yes, you can do that. And as I describe this to you, I'm suddenly realizing I better get to Dave real fast and tell him what he's got. He has got a vertical stacked array of 2-meter antennas, 6 or 7 high, and he can light up the whole darn East Coast with that array during a contest, and he hasn't yet gotten into electronic steering. If he wants to, he can electronically steer a null into the ground to stop that vertical lobing effect from ground reflection, and he can make even stronger signals. He has the resources. He's the first guy I know in ham radio world who can do what Dr. Warren White did. Look what you created by this question, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's why when I saw it, I said, oh, I said, this one is a lot more to it than you know, a simple answer. Now, you started mentioning, you know, getting into microwaves and the higher frequencies, a whole different, you know, situation. I mean, if we were to look at supposedly a excellent optical, from the optical standpoint, I would assume that something like that Puerto Rico big dish, that Acerivo dish, is a great reflecting surface that they started with, because it was a natural, you know, parabolic sort of surface, I guess, that they even improved upon. So I would assume that there is a very good example of, you know, what is actually taking place with, in other words, enormous brightness gain, you could say, if you could have a light actually reflecting on a surface, I guess you would consider it a big light reflector. But for, let's say for like this person was asking for like 20 meters, could we say then the rule of thumb is put the antenna approximately one wavelength on 20 meters, which is like you say, around 67 feet above the ground, the backyard ground, and that should put them in the ballpark, I would assume, Dick. I think that's about the best you can do. Am I correct? Over.
Sort of a yes and a no to that one, Mel. If he had the resources to mount his 20-meter dipole or 20-meter Yagi 67 feet or more above ground, and every bit of altitude he adds to it is going to give him a lower and lower angle of takeoff, therefore his first hop off that ionosphere is going to be more and more miles to it. Altitude is everything. So if you took the purest point of view and say, hey, always mount your antenna one wavelength above the ground or more, that's a little bit too severe, because a hell of a lot of guys have mounted their 20-meter dipole 20 feet off the ground and less, and yes, it is a near vertical incident skywave antenna, NVIS, NVIS antenna, but they've done some very good working with it. It didn't work long-range DX in general, but that NVIS antenna 20 feet off the ground may be the most ideal location to talk to your buddy in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh. And a higher antenna would do a better job of talking to your buddy in London. So, should an antenna always be mounted 20 feet above the ground? I mean, one wavelength above the ground? Not necessarily. Who cares if the signal reflected off the ground changes the impedance of your dipole? With a good antenna tuner, you recompensate, and your transmitter will see a perfect 50-ohm load. And you can put all the power you want into that dipole. Yes, a certain percentage of it is being coupled into the earth, and a little bit of it is heating up the earth. It would be a hell of a lot worse if it was a ground plane antenna mounted right on the ground. A horizontal dipole, any number of feet above ground, is way ahead in possibilities, in my opinion. So I don't think we should tell everybody it's got to be at least a wavelength. A wavelength is nice. Even more is even nicer. But a quarter of a wavelength above ground will still fly. It's not perfect, but the guy's going to talk to a lot of people, and for a certain kind of operation, it's going to make him happy. That's an opinion. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I know, this is on and on. Yes, of course, it's not always possible to get the height that you'd like. It would be beautiful, you know, to have those 100-foot towers plus everybody, and it would be, you know, grand to be able to, you know, have that availability. But for the most part, most people here can't get anywhere near that. So not to be discouraged, that like Dick says, but that 20-meter dipole, as high as you possibly can within reason. And it will work. It will work quite well. In fact, you will work DX stations. You may not be the strongest, nor in a pileup be the first one, but if you persist, you'll make the contact usually. I find that with a lot of these rear DX stations, when they first come on, I know the big gun guys. I know who I hear them coming on there, and I know I'm not going to try to compete with them. And I know that DX station is going to be around for a while, even many days, because they're not going on a DX expedition overnight, to stay overnight. So I know, let it go for a couple of days, let the big ones, big signals, and then wait for the propagation that's good for you to that point. Keep an eye on it. And then you work the DX, even with, in many cases, people with modest antennas. I guess that's the best advice overall. Enjoy ham radio. Shall we go on, Dick?
K2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Just to reiterate on what you were saying before, is that I have been using a 75-80 meter loop antenna that's little more than 6 feet off the ground. Quite literally, no higher than that off the ground. Tuned into a ballon, and then with feed line running south into an antenna tune. Now, one would think that that's a really, really poor antenna, but on the low end of 75, 80 meters, I can regularly talk to people in Europe, and with about 500 watts to a kilowatt, generally don't have much of a problem. I can usually hear them very well with relatively low noise, and it does. I do have to push more power than, say, most other people would in order to reach them, but generally, you know, and most evenings I can usually make it to Europe, no problem.
Fantastic. Let's have a few more words on this one, Glenn. 6 feet above the ground, how many feet long or circumference? Is it a full wavelength loop? If you had it opened at one end, it would be called the DDRR antenna, directional discontinuity ring radiator. If you close the loop at one end and feed it as a dipole, so to speak, and it's a full wavelength long, that'll give you a particular pattern. So how many feet circumference, 6 feet off the ground, is the first question. What gave you the enthusiasm to build this antenna? Was it a suggestion of somebody else's article, or you decided, hey, I've got the real estate, let's go do it? Give us a few more words on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, what started me with this was about a couple of years ago. I was experimenting, starting with my lowest frequency antennas first, you know, experimenting with dipoles, inverted Ds, everything else. And originally the best performing antenna I had down there for a wire antenna was my inverted D. But unfortunately, I didn't have the height that I wanted in the antenna. I wanted to actually get it up to about 75 feet. Unfortunately, my other beams and other antennas took that place, so I no longer had the height for my inverted D anymore. So from one of my receiving antennas, I had a loop antenna that basically took number 10-gauge wire and kind of stapled it along a picket fence. There's usually three pieces of wood along the picket fence, and it just stapled the wire and stapled it along the top of that, basically just around the backyard. And it kind of covered approximately about 275 feet in outer diameter and ran it back into to a single feed point, in which I fed two pieces of 75 ohm coax with the center leads connected to either side of the loop antenna, and I connected the shields together, run that back into a valve very, very close to the house, and then run coax into an antenna tuner. Let me let it drop for a second. Then from there, basically used the antenna tuner. Initially, I was using it as a receive antenna. I noticed that the signal strength was relatively strong, and started comparing the data on that antenna to other antennas, and I found out that it really wasn't that terrible on 75, 80 meters. And as a matter of fact, then I started using the antenna tuner to see if it would work on 40. It worked nicely on 40 as well. So I've been using it back and forth for that, and probably until I actually put my power back in and go back to my inverted D, I can see I'm going to be using this loop antenna for a while.
Very crafty. By using a pair of 75-ohm coax cables side by side, you have generated your own very low-loss 150-ohm shielded twin lead. The advantage of shielded twin lead is you can bend it any old way you want to, around corners. See, real twin lead, you have to obey a whole bunch of rules for it to work well. And by making shielded twin lead, you've gotten around that. Shielding a twin lead under normal circumstances makes the loss go up quite a bit faster, but you started off with pretty high-quality cable to begin with. I'm going to guess it was, I can't even think of the model number right now. RG59 would be the small diameter, and there's a larger diameter version of RG8, which I can't think of. You're going to tell me. So you've got a shielded, high efficiency twin lead, feeding the antenna, balancing, antenna tuner, and whatever. You live in Massapequa. I'd love to know roughly how close you are to the water in Massapequa. So these are Massapequa, I think, that are right on the waterfront, and there are portions that are quite far from it. The reason I'm asking that question is that maybe we can make a guess as to what your local soil conductivity is. Under normal circumstances, a person would predict that an antenna only 6 feet off the ground on 80 meters is really a needless antenna. It can only squirt the signal straight up. Obviously, by the fact that you're working Europe, something else is going on here. So give us a few more words, Glenn, What do you think is the breakthrough? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Firstly, just to answer the coax question,